Welcome back. It's Overtime on the Fan, taking you up until 7 o'clock. Toby Altizer with you. If you want to hop in, feel free, 800-636-1067 on the MGM National Harbor listener lines. You can also tweet at me, at Toby underscore Altizer. So CBS Sports put out a recent article talking about NFL players entering make-or-break 2024 seasons. So this is by Chris Trapazzo. We're taking a look at what they've got here. So we're taking a look at, he's got a couple different categories. The first one is former early picks in danger of being busts. He's got corner Kair Elam. He's a first-round pick by the Buffalo Bills a couple of years ago in the 2022 draft. He's definitely got some work to do. And this is my guy. This right here is my guy. And I want him to break out so bad. Maybe he's more my fantasy football guy. But Rashad Bateman. I was so high on Bateman coming out of Minnesota. I believed all the hype, and he just hasn't been able to live up to it. Some of it's been injuries. Other, it's just he hasn't been very productive.
My late-round fantasy flyer king.
Yeah, I love Rashad Bateman. 2021 draft pick. He's going to have to get things going, or maybe he's going to have to move on to another team, especially with the emergence and just how good Zay Flowers was last year. Rashad Bateman, I think those are both good names. Veterans on their last legs. He has Tyler Lockett. Lockett's interesting because, you know, you look at them drafting Jackson Smith and Jigba last year. Like, I'm kind of surprised they didn't use Jackson Smith and Jigba a little bit more. And now you're looking at a guy that is getting up there in age a little bit. Really, that whole, you know, that whole battery right there of Tyler Lockett and Geno Smith might be on their last leg, both of those guys.
Yeah, JSN was battling injury a little bit last year, so I think that's why Lockett got a little bit more usage. But I think JSN's going to see a little bit bigger of a role this next year.
Jordan Poyer fits into the other one, and Poyer was a really, really good player for Buffalo for a long time. Now he moves on. He's playing with the Miami Dolphins. I'm interested to see how he does there. I think Poyer can still play a little bit, but he's getting up there in age as well. So now we find where the Commanders are on this article. Players who dipped after playing well early and are now in a prove-it year. Any guess?
Montez Sweat?
Commanders.
He's not in a prove-it year, sorry.
The players on the Commanders.
Oh, my apologies. Brain fart.
Not Montez Sweat.
Thinking.
There's two of them. One offense, one defense. I mean, come on.
Jamin's in a prove it year, but we're talking about vets, aren't we?
Yeah. Players who played well early, who are now in a prove it year. There's one on the offense, one on the defense. The one on offense should be easy. I mean, it should be pretty obvious.
I'm gonna be kicking myself for hours, Toby.
You don't know who it is on offense?
You're gonna have to tell me.
Jahan Dotson?
Yeah, this is true.
Defense, I don't think you're gonna get Jeremy Chin.
Yeah, no, I was never gonna get that.
So offense for Jahan Dotson, here's where it gets interesting with Dotson. Okay. He's in his third year now. After this season, before going into next year, they're gonna have to make a decision on his fifth year option. Now the question is, are they going to pick up the fifth-year option? I don't know that even that's the question, because the answer is no. What would change that? Like, what would he have to do this year for them to consider picking up the fifth-year option? Like, to me, if he goes for 700 yards, no. 800 yards, no. 900 yards, no. Even 1,000 yards this year, I still think no. It has to be something where he's going for, like, 1,200, 1,300 yards. Because you've had 2 years where his... Like, let's just look at his stats. Because if you look back to his rookie year, like, he was solid, no doubt about it. He wasn't as spectacular as sometimes we made him out to be. And look, last year, I thought he was going to be a stud. I thought he was going to explode. I thought he was going to be fantastic coming off of that rookie season, because I thought he was going to take that next step. To me, it's similar. We do this with players all the time, because what we get excited about is the potential, not necessarily the actual production. Right, when we look back at like Chase Young's rookie year, he was awesome. But you look back at 7.5 sacks. 7.5 sacks in the modern NFL for an edge rusher, that's not stud numbers. You're expecting double digit. Why did you get so excited about Chase Young? Well, because you thought, okay, 7.5 sacks, he's going to build off that and be awesome. Jahan Dotson's rookie year, 35 receptions, 523 yards, 7 touchdowns. It's not bad numbers by any means. He also didn't even get above 550. Like, he's at 523. And it was only 12 games. It was 10 starts, about 43 yards a game. So let's see. If he did 43.6 yards per game and played all 17 games now, 43.6 times 17 is 741. So he was on a pace for less than 750 yards in a season. Why did we get so excited about him after his rookie year? We thought he was going to build off it, right? We thought he could take that next step. He didn't do any of that last year. He took a step backwards, if not two or three steps backwards. He played more games. He played in every game last year, which is encouraging. So he wasn't dealing with the injuries. But at times last year, when I was watching Jahan Dotson, at times last year, I didn't feel like he was running fully, which I don't know what was going on there. You know, you talk to some people at PFF, like I talked with Nick Ackridge during the year, and he basically said that he thought Dotson was still running effective routes and getting open. He just wasn't getting the ball. I don't know what was going on, but Jahan Dotson's now barely eclipsed 1,000 yards in his career, much less a season. He's at 1,041 yards in his career. Last year, he went for 518, 4 touchdowns. You know, his rookie year, the other selling point wasn't necessarily just the yardage totals and, you know, a solid guy that can work in the slot or work outside and be a little bit shifty. He was a good red zone threat. 7 touchdowns last year in 12 games. That's nice. He played all 17 last year and scored 4 and went for 5 fewer yards. And a lot of that's Bieniemy, I get it. A lot of that's Sam Howell, I get it. Still a lot of blame to go on Jahan Dotson as well. Frankly, at times it felt like he wasn't even a part of the team anymore. He didn't pop off the screen. Like, when he touched the ball his rookie year, he popped off the screen. You think about that Giants game where he catches the ball and then spins, ends up in the end zone. That was awesome. We didn't see any of that last year. None of it. So honestly, when you think about it, third year this year, if he doesn't pop off big time, he's not getting that fifth year option. And it shows you once again, looking back on previous draft classes, you declined the fifth year option on Jamin Davis. You declined the fifth year option on Chase Young. You know, you're probably going to decline the fifth-year option on Jahan Dotson. We'll see on Emmanuel Forbes. We still got 2 more years before that happens, but what gives you confidence that that's going to be any different? It's not been great. You're going to need something out of Jahan Dotson this year, and it's going to have to be big because the other part of this, you know, if Jahan Dotson can prove himself and go out there and play well, maybe he can earn himself at least a little bit something. They're probably not picking up the fifth-year option, but maybe he's working himself to say, all right, we're going to decline the fifth-year option, but maybe we'll start working on some sort of a deal that's a little bit less than that. I don't know. But when you think about it, who's behind him on the depth chart? Because there's not anyone pushing him aside from a Luke McCaffrey. Like, you think Alamide Zaccheaus is going to be a big part? Like, I think he'll play a role in the offense, but you Alamide Zaccheaus is the guy you're worried about?
Deami Brown's nipping at his heels.
Deami Brown, Demir Byrd, like, there's not people behind him. Like, Danny Ruye's been all over this, to his credit. When you look at the receiving core, outside of Terry, truly, outside of Terry, there are no sure things. Jahan has not been a sure thing. Because even last year, the most sure thing about Jahan Dotson coming into the league was his hands. Last year, he's dropping passes. And honestly, he dropped some passes his rookie year, too. I mean, Jahan has so much to prove this year. I'm a big fan. I think that he's got a lot of talent. Maybe it's one of those cases where, you know, just wrong place, wrong time. It doesn't work out here. You know, they don't pick up the fifth-year option. He goes somewhere else and does well in a couple years. Wouldn't surprise me one bit. But when you look at Jahan Dotson going into this year, absolutely it's a prove-it year. He has to go out there and ball out, or he's not getting that fifth-year option picked up. And frankly, I just don't even know that there's a number that he can go out and put up. It's not the regime that drafted him. I just don't know that there's a number he can go put up that they're going to feel like, ooh, I got to pick up that fifth-year option. He's going to have to ball out this year just to even be considered to be a long-term part of this franchise, and that's what we were talking about earlier a little bit. Like, how many building blocks are on this team? If you would have asked me before last season, Jahan Dotson's in that list. You ask me right now, I don't know that Jahan's on the list. Just don't think he is. And I hope he proves me wrong. I hope he goes out and balls out. I hope it's something that they eventually pick up the fifth-year option because he plays so well. I don't think it's going to happen. I do not think that's going to happen. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some of your phone calls, as well as want to talk about Jeremy Chinn, and he kind of fits into this as well, a little bit of a prove-it year. We'll talk about it next here on The Fan. It's overtime on The Fan. Toby Altizer taking you up until 7 o'clock. 800-636-1067. You want to hop in on the MGM National Harbor listener lines, talking about two Commanders that CBS Sports say are in prove-it years, make-it-or-break-it years, Jahan Dotson being one of them, Jeremy Chinn the other. We talked about Jahan Dotson. I don't know that he's going to have his fifth-year option picked up, and I don't know that there's anything he can do about it. He can play well this year. I don't think it's going to be picked up. What do you think about Dotson? What do you think about Chinn? 800-636-1067. Let's get out to Sean, who is in D.C. Sean, what's going on?
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I know a lot of people are going to be upset with me, but I don't care. Terry McLaurin is not a number one receiver. And I feel that the young man that we just drafted, McCaffrey is going to come in, be our number one receiver. He's 6'3". He's what the Commanders are looking for in a receiver. Or what they should do is go out there and get DeAndre Hopkins. I called yesterday, and the guy hung up on me because I said IU will be our new number one receiver if Washington go gets a IU. But Terry McLaurin, he catches 3 catches a game. He catch a bomb, and everyone get excited. He's not a Justin Jefferson. He's no number one receiver. Thank you for taking my call. I hope we go get DeAndre Hopkins, though. Have a good one.
Appreciate it, Sean. A couple of things off of that. DeAndre Hopkins, he's the typical mold of a number one, but at this point in his career, I don't see the point in going in and getting a DeAndre Hopkins. They're not trying to win the Super Bowl this year. Would he make them better this year? Absolutely, but I just don't see the point in that. Ayuk is intriguing to me, and he does fit more the mold of a traditional number one. If you want to take the approach that Terry McLaurin only catches 3 balls a game and it's all his fault, fine. I just tend to think there are a lot of other factors that are holding him back and have nothing to do with Terry. I think he does his job well. I think he is a number one receiver, but if you want to disagree, I just spent probably, what, an hour talking about Terry McLaurin. I don't need to spend any more. Jahan Dotson, though, I think has a big opportunity this year as the number two receiver behind Terry. He's going to have to step up. He's going to have to step up big time. Last year, I was talking about him thinking that he could be in that same tier as Terry. I was clearly mistaken. I was clearly mistaken. Like, this is a guy I thought had the route running chops, I thought had the hands, and some of the shiftiness that even Terry doesn't have. And he just has not been able to live up to the expectations. And some of it, yes, people love to bring up that they maybe overdrafted him, sure, a little bit. He's still, in my opinion, a first-round type receiver, early second round, so he's still got the talent. He's got to come up big this year. He has to. It's one of those things where he's going to have to prove it for a fifth-year option, which I talked about. I don't think he's going to get it picked up. But he's going to have to go out there and prove it, even if it's not for the Commanders. He's going to have to prove it for someone else, if they maybe want to trade him in the next offseason, or if he's going to be the guy. I don't know. He's got a lot to prove this season. The other guy that they mention here is Jeremy Chinn, and it's interesting because Chinn's in a prove-it year of sorts after a team's already moved on from him, where Chinn was second in Defensive Rookie of the Year voting in 2020. Behind Chase Young, and he played super well. I don't know that he was thought to be as good as he was. I remember we talked about Cam Curl all the time and how good he was, and people would argue, oh, but Jeremy Chinn and Cam Curl continue to play at a high level, maybe not as good as he did early on, but still played at a high level, and Jeremy Chinn kind of faded into obscurity a little bit. He was someone that just didn't get talked about a whole lot. Now he walks into a place where Dan Quinn and Joe Witt Jr., I think, are going to use some of these guys. Matter of fact, Dan Quinn was talking at minicamp a couple of weeks ago. I think we have that audio, Max, if you want to grab that. And he was talking about some of these different guys who were versatile and talking about Chinn. He talked about Luvu. He talked about some of these guys. Maybe we can dive into those other guys another time. but he specifically talked about Chin as well in this conversation. Here's Dan Quinn.
I would say some of what I was hoping to see, I did, and maybe that's with Chin. I would say it's been good to see Martin, you know, some down in the box, but some as a middle field safety. Luvu, although I knew that was a part of his game, I'd say it was probably even stronger than I thought. So those would be some, you know, that jump out to me. And now on the offensive side, we've worked, you know, some receivers who could move into the backfield and vice versa. So, yeah, it's an ongoing process. But sometimes you just try it, take a look, and not. Same thing with the kick return.
I think with you, what you heard early in that is he's talking about Chin and they're trying to move him around and use him as a chess piece of sorts. And he's been able to play well in those spots, you know, whether it's coming down and playing maybe as a little bit of a nickel corner or playing that Buffalo nickel position that they like to talk about, almost like a linebacker of sorts or a in-box safety of sorts. So I'm intrigued by Chin because he's a guy that is very versatile, and I've talked about this defense and how excited I am about it because of how they're going to be able to play, where it's going to be very versatile, it's going to be multiple, they're going to be able to use guys in different roles, and it stands out when you have a guy like Joe Witt Jr. come out and say, it's not 11 starters on defense, we're going to use 16, 17, 18 different guys. Chin being one of those guys, and they're going to use him in different ways. It is a big-time prove-it year for him. So I think these two guys, I think they nailed it here for CBS Sports, where Jahan Dotson has so much to prove on the offensive side of the ball. Chin, I know he's new, and I know he's coming over here, but it's a big prove-it year for him where, you know, he's only under contract for 1 year, so if he plays incredibly well, maybe he gets a big contract here or somewhere else. Otherwise, if he doesn't prove much, maybe he just continues going around and being a bit of a backup and a little bit of a chess piece around the league, but not being the guy that we saw early on in his career. So big prove-it years for Chin and for Dotson. All right, let's get into some NBA draft talk. Alex Saar was a big name that's been talked about. He was someone that a lot of people thought was going to go number one overall. He still hasn't worked out for the Hawks, who have the number one overall pick, so maybe that kind of shuts the door there. One person on ESPN said Alex Saar at number two to the Wizards is a lock. We'll talk about it next here on The Fan. Next week. It's crazy we're already there. Next Wednesday, the Wizards have the second overall pick. Talked a little bit about some of the guys I liked the other day, but Alex Saar is, according to Jonathan Giovanni, he started Draft Express, now does stuff with ESPN as well. He said Alex Saar to the Wizards at number two is pretty much a lock. What do you think? 800-636-1067 on the MGM National Harbor Listener Lines. Do you want Saar? Is that your top guy? I know Linnell was getting a little fired up the other day about the fact that Wizards fans aren't big on Reese Hachette, but it sounds like Reese Hachette is likely to go number one overall, so probably doesn't even matter. If you have the choice, Alex Saar, Klingon, Castle. Yeah, I think it's interesting because Saar might have the highest ceiling of anybody in this class because when you just look at him, there's not many people that are built like him. He's 7'1 with a 7'4 wingspan, a guy that can play all over the floor because of his versatility and athleticism. You've got a guy that you feel like you can coach up to go alongside with another athletic freak in Koulibaly. Maybe you can end up with something there. You know, you've got a big front court. But the intriguing thing about Saar is, like, defensively, he's versatile. He can play really good on ball. I was reading some stuff about him before the show today. I think The Ringer put out a really good pros and cons of drafting Alex Saar piece together. Kevin O'Connor put it out. He thought their best fit, or the best fit for Saar, would be with the Hawks because you can pair him with a top-level point guard versus what the Wizards have. They just don't have a guy that would be able to work with him like that. But I think when you look at Saar, I think it would make sense for them to take him. You know, personally, my top guy, just maybe because I've seen the impact of a guy like a Drew Holiday, my top guy that I would like is a Stephon Castle. The issue with Castle, though, is you can't take guards in the modern NBA that can't shoot. Guards in the modern NBA that can't shoot are useless. They might be good defensively. They might be able to help you some with their playmaking, But dudes just play so far off of them that they can't get anything accomplished. So if you're a guard that can't shoot, then you're really, really hurting yourself. Versus if you're a big man that can't shoot, yes, that adds an element to the game and people are really looking for that and they really like to run these five out sorts of sets. But if you're a point guard or a shooting guard and you can't shoot, you just basically can't make it. You really can't. Like when you think about big men that can't shoot, like there are still ways that you can get around it because we look at what the Dallas Mavericks did. It's not like Gafford and Lively were shooting threes. And I think in some ways you see a little bit of Derek Lively in an Alex Sarr. But I think he's a little bit better with the ball and offensively. Like Lively is pretty much a rim runner on the offensive side of the ball, and he's a good defender inside the paint. Sarr is probably not as good inside the paint as a Lively, but you can see a little bit. I actually thought it was interesting to see Kevin O'Connor compares him to Nick Claxton, which speaks to the lack of talent in this year's draft. If at number two overall you're drafting Nick Claxton, I like Claxton. I think he's a nice piece, and I think he's an intriguing skill set. But I'm sorry, he's not exactly the most exciting NBA player. Like, if you look at the tail of the tape between these two guys, Alex Sarr is just under 7 feet, 6'11 and three quarters. Claxton's at 6'10. Sarr's at 224. Claxton's at 217. Their wingspan is within 2 inches. Sarr's is 7'4 and a quarter. And you've got Claxton at 7'2 and a half. Their reach is about the same at 9'2. Standing vert's a little bit better for Claxton at 31 and a half versus 30 and a half for Sarr. Max vert's about the same, 37 for Sarr, 36 and a half for Claxton. Again, just taking a look at the Ringer's piece on Alex Sarr. Like, Claxton's a solid player, and he's someone that's intriguing because of his versatility and his ability to move all over the floor at his size. And Claxton has improved to the point that he's a solid finisher inside. I wouldn't say he's great, but he's a solid finisher inside, but he doesn't give you much outside of the paint. When you look at a Sarr, he has the ability down the line to maybe be a good mid-range shooter and maybe even a decent to solid outside shooter from beyond the arc. I don't know that he ever reaches a superstar status, though. And that's the issue, though. I don't know that there's anybody in this draft that reaches a superstar status. Like, if Stephon Castle could shoot, I don't think there'd be any question that he could maybe do it. But if Stephon Castle would shoot, he'd unquestionably be the number one overall pick. So the Wizards wouldn't even have a chance. So I don't know. When you look at Alex Sarr, I think that he might have the highest potential, and it just strictly has to do with his size. You know, I was watching some clips in this piece, and it's interesting that he can be almost a lockdown perimeter defender at 7 feet tall. Like, his lateral quickness, his ability to move is impressive, but also you see in the piece that he has some struggles when he's the drop defender on the pick and roll and defending at the rim, and you're kind of wondering, like, dude, you're 7 foot tall. You should be able to block these shots. Like, you think about the impact that Kristaps Porzingis had in that final series, where when Kristaps played, he was able to block shots at the rim, and it made it much, much harder for Kyrie and Luka. So I don't know. Like, I like Sarr, and he probably has the highest ceiling, but again, it speaks to the lack of top-end talent in this year's draft that we're talking about Alex Sarr as the number two overall pick. I think he's an intriguing prospect and he has the highest ceiling, but it's also because the rest of the guys have like role player type ceilings. Like, you look at a Klingon versus a Sarr, the athleticism is better for a Sarr. Like, there's no doubt about it. When you watch Klingon, he looks like your typical big man, where it's a little bit of lumbering around at times just because he's so big, and there's no problem with that. He's 7'2", so that's fine. Sarr moves more like a wing, more like a three that you would expect. But when you watch Klingon on the offensive end, you can have Klingon set up in the post and go to work. It'd be interesting to see how that translates to the NBA level, because you're going to have to be an effective scorer for them to even care that you're going one-on-one in the post. But I think he can actually have his offensive game translate probably pretty quickly just because he can give you that work in the post, but he's not going to give you anything as a shooter. He's not a particularly good free throw shooter. So what makes you think he can be a effective three-point shooter? I just don't think that's going to happen. And I don't know that you have to have a big man that can shoot, but you would like it. And I think Klingon can give you more on the inside, but he can't give you the type of defending on the outside and versatility defending like an Alex Sarr. Because Sarr can switch on to guys. He can move all over the place. He can play on the help side. Like, he can do a lot of different things. He's just so athletic. He fits the modern brand of basketball where you just get dudes that are freakishly athletic and hope you can turn them into really good basketball players. Alex Sarr fits that mold versus Klingon's already a really good basketball player. He just lacks some of the athleticism that some of these other guys have. But he's also 7'2". So he doesn't necessarily need to be as crazy athletic, and he already understands how to play good defense in the paint and block shots. It just shows how underwhelming this draft is because it's those dudes, it's Risha Shea, it's Castle, maybe a Mataz Buzelis is in there. Like, it's just hopefully the Wizards have done a good job scouting these guys and have everything ready to roll. And that's the thing that I thought was interesting. G&D were talking about the other day. Which of these front offices do you trust the most? You know, the Wizards just haven't had a big chance to prove themselves yet, similar to what you saw last year with, you know, the Harris ownership group taking over and maybe not having a chance to put their stamp on stuff. Will Dawkins and company came in and they had a chance with the draft, but they weren't able to do as much as they would have liked. I'm interested to see what ultimately happens with Kuz and Poole if they just kind of run it back with those guys and see what happens. They signed Brian Keefe as the head coach. I don't know that that's a hiring that inspires a lot of people. Not that it's a bad hire, but I don't know that that's moving the needle for a lot of people. It seemed like the players liked it, but frankly, when the players suck and you win what was their record last year? 14-68 or something. Like, I forget what their record was. Like, when you win that few games, I don't know that I care what your opinion is on the coach. You didn't win enough games for me to feel like I need to be dialed into what you want. 15 games, excuse me. I gypped him of one. I'm sorry. 15-67.
Hey, that's a higher percentage than you'd think.
But frankly, again, I don't know that I'm like, woohoo, I'm glad that they, like, next week, it's crazy we're already there. Next Wednesday, the Wizards have the second overall pick. Talked a little bit about some of the guys I liked the other day, but Alex Sarr is, according to Jonathan Giovanni, he started Draft Express, now does stuff with ESPN as well. He said Alex Sarr to the Wizards at number two is pretty much a lock. What do you think? 800-636-1067 on the MGM National Harbor Listener Lines. Do you want Sarr? Is that your top guy? I know Linnell was getting a little fired up the other day about the fact that Wizards fans aren't big on Risha Shea, but it sounds like Risha Shea is likely to go number one overall, so probably doesn't even matter. If you have the choice, Alex Sarr, Klingon, Castle. Yeah, I think it's interesting because Sarr might have the highest ceiling of anybody in this class because when you just look at him, there's not many people that are built like him. He's 7'1 with a 7'4 wingspan, a guy that can play all over the floor because of his versatility and athleticism. You've got a guy that you feel like you can coach up to go alongside with another athletic freak in Koulibaly. Maybe you can end up with something there. You know, you've got a big front court. But the intriguing thing about Sarr is, like, defensively, he's versatile. He can play really good on ball. I was reading some stuff about him before the show today. I think The Ringer put out a really good pros and cons of drafting Alex Sarr piece together. Kevin O'Connor put it out. He thought their best fit, or the best fit for Sarr, would be with the Hawks because you can pair him with a top-level point guard versus what the Wizards have. They just don't have a guy that would be able to work with him like that. But I think when you look at Sarr, I think it would make sense for them to take him. You know, personally, my top guy just maybe because I've seen the impact of a guy like a Drew Holiday. My top guy that I would like is a Stephon Castle. The issue with Castle, though, is you can't take guards in the modern NBA that can't shoot. Guards in the modern NBA that can't shoot are useless. They might be good defensively. They might be able to help you some with their playmaking. But dudes just play so far off of them that they can't get anything accomplished. So if you're a guard that can't shoot, then you're really, really hurting yourself. Versus if you're a big man that can't shoot, yes, that adds an element to the game and people are really looking for that and they really like to run these five out sorts of sets. But if you're a point guard or a shooting guard and you can't shoot, you just basically can't make it. You really can't. Like when you think about big men that can't shoot, like there are still ways that you can get around it because we look at what the Dallas Mavericks did. It's not like Gafford and Lively were shooting threes. And I think in some ways you see a little bit of Derek Lively in an Alex Sarr. But I think he's a little bit better with the ball and offensively. Like Lively is pretty much a rim runner on the offensive side of the ball, and he's a good defender inside the paint. Sarr is probably not as good inside the paint as a Lively, but you can see a little bit. I actually thought it was interesting to see Kevin O'Connor compares him to Nick Claxton, which speaks to the lack of talent in this year's draft. If at number two overall you're drafting Nick Claxton, I like Claxton. I think he's a nice piece, and I think he's an intriguing skill set. But I'm sorry, he's not exactly the most exciting NBA player. Like, if you look at the tail of the tape between these two guys, Alex Sarr is just under 7 feet, 6'11 and three quarters. Claxton's at 6'10. Sarr's at 224. Claxton's at 217. Their wingspan is within 2 inches. Sarr's is 7'4 and a quarter, and you've got Claxton at 7'2 and a half. Their reach is about the same at 9'2. Standing vert's a little bit better for Claxton at 31 and a half versus 30 and a half for Sarr. Max vert's about the same, 37 for Sarr, 36 and a half for Claxton. Again, just taking a look at the Ringer's piece on Alex Sarr. Like, Claxton's a solid player, and he's someone that's intriguing because of his versatility and his ability to move all over the floor at his size. And Claxton has improved to the point that he's a solid finisher inside. I wouldn't say he's great, but he's a solid finisher inside, but he doesn't give you much outside of the paint. When you look at a Sarr, he has the ability down the line to maybe be a good mid-range shooter and maybe even a decent to solid outside shooter from beyond the arc. I don't know that he ever reaches a superstar status, though, and that's the issue, though. I don't know that there's anybody in this draft that reaches a superstar status. Like, if Stephon Castle could shoot, I don't think there'd be any question that he could maybe do it, but if Stephon Castle would shoot, he'd unquestionably be the number one overall pick. So the Wizards wouldn't even have a chance. So I don't know. When you look at Alex Sarr, I think that he might have the highest potential, and it just strictly has to do with his size. You know, I was watching some clips in this piece, and it's interesting that he can be almost a lockdown perimeter defender at 7 feet tall. Like, his lateral quickness, his ability to move is impressive. But also, you see in the piece that he has some struggles when he's the drop defender on the pick and roll and defending at the rim. And you're kind of wondering, like, dude, you're 7 foot tall. You should be able to block these shots. Like, you think about the impact that Kristaps Porzingis had in that final series where when Kristaps played, he was able to block shots at the rim, and it made it much, much harder for Kyrie and Luka. So I don't know. Like, I like Sarr, and he probably has the highest ceiling. But again, it speaks to the lack of top-end talent in this year's draft that we're talking about Alex Sarr as the number two overall pick. I think he's an intriguing prospect, and he has the highest ceiling. But it's also because the rest of the guys have, like, role-player-type ceilings. Like, you look at a Klingon versus a Sarr, the athleticism is better for a Sarr. Like, there's no doubt about it. When you watch Klingon, he looks like your typical big man where it's a little bit of lumbering around at times just because he's so big, and there's no problem with that. He's 7'2", so that's fine. Sark moves more like a wing, more like a three that you would expect. But when you watch Klingon on the offensive end, you can have Klingon set up in the post and go to work. It'd be interesting to see how that translates to the NBA level, because you're going to have to be an effective scorer for them to even care that you're going one-on-one in the post. But I think he can actually have his offensive game translate probably pretty quickly, just because he can give you that work in the post, but he's not going to give you anything as a shooter. He's not a particularly good free throw shooter. So what makes you think he can be a effective three-point shooter? I just don't think that's going to happen. And I don't know that you have to have a big man that can shoot, but you would like it. And I think Klingon can give you more on the inside, but he can't give you the type of defending on the outside and versatility defending like an Alex Sark. Because Sark can switch on to guys. He can move all over the place. He can play on the help side. Like, he can do a lot of different things. He's just so athletic. He fits the modern brand of basketball where you just get dudes that are freakishly athletic and hope you can turn them into really good basketball players. Alex Sark fits that mold versus Klingon's already a really good basketball player. He just lacks some of the athleticism that some of these other guys have. But he's also 7'2". So he doesn't necessarily need to be as crazy athletic, and he already understands how to play good defense in the paint and block shots. It just shows how underwhelming this draft is, because it's those dudes, it's Risha Shea, it's Castle, maybe a Mataz Buzelis is in there. Like, it's just hopefully the Wizards have done a good job scouting these guys and have everything ready to roll. And that's the thing that I thought was interesting. G&D were talking about the other day. Which of these front offices do you trust the most? You know, the Wizards just haven't had a big chance to prove themselves yet, similar to what you saw last year with, you know, the Harris ownership group taking over and maybe not having a chance to put their stamp on stuff. Will Dawkins and company came in and they had a chance with the draft, but they weren't able to do as much as they would have liked. I'm interested to see what ultimately happens with Kuz and Poole, if they just kind of run it back with those guys and see what happens. They signed Brian Keefe as the head coach. I don't know that, you know, I don't know that that's a hiring that inspires a lot of people. Not that it's a bad hire, but I don't know that that's moving the needle for a lot of people. It seemed like the players liked it, but frankly, when the players suck and you win what was their record last year? 14-68 or something. Like, I forget what their record was. Like, when you win that few games, I don't know that I care what your opinion is on the coach. You didn't win enough games for me to feel like I need to be dialed into what you want. 15 games. Excuse me. I gypped him of one. I'm sorry. 15-67.
Hey, that's a higher percentage than you'd think.
But frankly, again, I don't know that I'm like, woohoo, I'm glad that they talk about how much better they played in the second half, and I think the difference in their record is like two games better. Like, they won eight games or something like that under Brian Keefe and seven under Wes Unseld. Like, it just wasn't good last year whatsoever. And it's just, isn't it just Wizards luck too that they finally get a draft pick up this high and it's the crappiest draft we've seen in a long time?
That's why you got to position yourself for Cooper Flagg.
Yeah, just keep tanking. Trust the process. Are we going to, Josh Harris is in town now, so we're just going to go with the process, full on process.
That's right, baby.
It's frustrating, but I think that there are still guys. You know, we had Chase Hughes on the other day, and he talked about, I think it was the 2013 draft that was viewed as a very bad draft. Anthony Bennett, I believe, went first overall. Giannis Antetokounmpo was drafted in that draft. Giannis is going to go down as one of the best players of all time. So you can find someone, and the Wizards don't just have the second overall pick. They have, you know, 26 as well. So I'm interested to see what they can get. That's going to come up next Wednesday. I believe Linnell has coverage of that, so make sure you're checking us out here and also over on the Team 980 for great coverage of the Wizards NBA draft. I want to talk about something we saw in baseball the other day, the really cool tribute to the Negro Leagues and Willie Mays at Rickwood Field. I thought that was a fantastic presentation and game. I want to talk about that, as well as what are some other ideas for games like that? Maybe not even just in baseball, but different places that games could be played that I think would, that you think would be cool like that. We'll talk about that next here on The Fan. So the other night, there was an awesome baseball game on. It was the Cardinals and the Giants. Ordinarily wouldn't care one lick about it, but it was a fantastic, fantastic presentation put on by Major League Baseball at Rickwood Field in Birmingham, Alabama. It was really cool. It was really cool. If you didn't get a chance to watch it, you missed out because they did a fantastic job with it. It's one of the best baseball broadcasts I've watched in quite some time, and I can only imagine how cool it was to be there in person as well. Like, to get to experience that, it was awesome. So, you know, at Rickwood Field, they were there for honoring the Negro Leagues and also honoring Willie Mays. And it was really cool to watch. You know, I thought, you know, the pregame ceremonies and everything were awesome. The national anthem, like everything was really cool leading up to it. And then hearing just the different stories of people talking, some of the legends from the Negro Leagues and all that, and hearing just the stories about Willie Mays, and I think his name is Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro Leagues Hall of Fame, was fantastic. Like, it was really, really cool to just hear all the different stories and see the different stuff that they did, right? Like, you know, Tom Verducci's walking around in the outfield or where the original wall was, which is, like, stupidly long. Like, I don't even know how you hit a home run there. You know, hearing all the old tales of who hit the longest home run there. And, you know, I'm sure people have heard the tale about Babe Ruth hitting a ball that landed on a train and didn't stop until it was at its destination. It's the longest home run ever hit. That was at Rickwood Field. And all that stuff, it was so cool to see. And then on the broadcast, they did a fantastic job of, you know, having guys on to tell different stories. And then they even showed an inning like it was 1954. Did you catch that?
No, I didn't.
It was in black and white. They used like old-time graphics where it would pop up, you know, like just the old-time, the name, like nothing else, like just name, batting average, and art, like it just very simple stuff. It was really cool. One of my favorite broadcasts I've ever watched. They did a fantastic job with it. And I think Major League Baseball, as much as we love to hate on them for some of the stuff that they do, they've done a fantastic job with some of these destination games. Like, you think about this game, and I think they did a great job of honoring Willie Mays and honoring the tradition and the history of the Negro Leagues. And they did a really good job with what happened this year, obviously the passing of Willie Mays, but they're integrating the stats from the Negro Leagues into Major League Baseball history, which, you know, has been caught with some mixed reviews, but generally it's been positive. Like, they should be recognized. They are legends of the game, and I think that's really cool. You add all that in and then have that culminate with a game at Rickwood Field. That was really cool. But you think about the Field of Dreams game, you know, the last couple of years has been really cool as well. Those sorts of things are awesome.
Like the games in Williamsport, too?
Yeah, like the game in Williamsport. Like, I think they do a really, really good job with that stuff. You know, as much as we love to give them crap about different things, like, they've done a fantastic job with these destination games of making them intriguing, giving you, you know, a reason to want to watch these things, pulling on the history, pulling on some of the various storylines, and doing a really good job of it. And the settings always look really cool. Like, you think about that Field of Dreams game, who wouldn't want to? If you've watched that movie, who wouldn't want to go there and just play catch? Or, as they say, have a catch, right? Like, who wouldn't want to go there and just play baseball? It's really cool. And you think about Rickwood Field and the history there where Willie Mays made his debut and the cool stuff there and all the stuff surrounding that. That was awesome. Like, that looked like, you know, you were put in a time machine and went back in time and watched old school baseball back in the day, which was really cool. So that was fun to watch. You think about even some of the other sports that have done stuff like this. Some of my favorite things were, remember when they'd have basketball games, college basketball games on the aircraft carriers? Like, how cool is that?
Oh, man, we need to bring that back so bad.
Like, that sort of stuff I really like. I think that sort of stuff is really cool. What are some other ideas for stuff like that? That would be cool if leagues could introduce that, or even colleges could introduce that. 800-636-1067, if you want to hop in on the MGM National Harbor listener lines. What are some other ideas for some stuff?
One just came to my head. A football game on the infield of a NASCAR race.
They've done that.
When?
Not during a race.
I think they should.
But they've done it.
I think
Tennessee
they should.
And Virginia Tech played a game at Bristol. It's the largest attended game ever. Remember, like, and they had some stupid large scoreboard that was like, I would not trust playing under that thing, by the way. But it was held up by a bunch of cables right over the field, like that. That's that terrifying. Was crazy. Let's see how many people attended that, because yeah, that is a good one. Virginia Tech and Tennessee, I believe, was the game. But what are some other ideas for those sorts of things? So they played, it was September 10th, 2016, at the Bristol Motor Speedway, 45-24, Tennessee won. I'm trying to see what the attendance
was. Oh, I've got it.
What was the attendance?
I want you to guess.
Well, it's too late now.
156,000.
Yeah, 156,990. That is really cool, though. That's a great idea. It really is a good idea. That's pretty cool. Now, I can't even imagine sitting on one of the end zone seats. You couldn't see the game.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Like, you couldn't see the game, but that's a pretty cool one. What are some other ones, though? I've got some ideas. So I've got one. Logistically, I have no idea how you can make it happen. No idea. But I think it would be really, really cool. Maybe it's more something you have to do with an exhibition. How cool would it be to watch a bunch of NBA players or high-level college basketball players playing a game at Rucker Park?
Yeah.
In NYC. And even if it's something where you can find a way to, like, near that area and, like, I don't know what you'd have to do, but to put down a hardwood floor and they could go play on it. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
That'd be sick.
I would love something like that. Another one I have an idea, because it's not necessarily... And you think about those destination games, like those are used, you know, once every couple of years, once every year or whatever. This one's used multiple times a year because it's a Packers home stadium, Lambeau. Play a Super Bowl there.
See, that's the thing that's rubbed me the wrong way about Super Bowls the past, I don't know, 15 years or whatever. Let's get them outdoors. Let's get them out in the elements,
well,
man.
Okay, so I'm
real football is outside.
In general, I am one when it comes to the biggest game of the year. I want to take away all the variables. I want it to be the two teams going against each other.
Not real ball.
So I'm all for playing it in a dome, which I don't like domes in general. I kind of like open stadiums. So I actually don't even mind SoFi, but I would prefer natural grass.
Yeah.
I'm a natural grass fan.
Big time.
But when it comes to playing in a Super Bowl, I like taking away the variable of the weather, and you truly just play the two best teams against each other, and that's it. But they played a Super Bowl in New York, and it rained.
It's true, it did.
So, like, I don't know. I know it's going to be cold in Green Bay in February. Believe me, I've been there. So I understand. But I don't know. I think it'd be cool to have a Super Bowl at Lambeau Field. Like, the history of Lambeau.
Completely agree.
There's zero chance it would ever happen.
Cowards.
0.0% chance it ever happened, unless they somehow built some sort of canopy over it. It's not going to happen.
A big tarp.
But I would love if they could do something like that. Are there any others? It is kind of funny, though. I will say this is a little bit funny. Like, with baseball, they do a Field of Dreams game. That's literally off a movie.
Yeah.
like, at least with Rickwood Field, like, you're honoring the Negro Leagues, which it's been far too long. But also, by the way, whenever you honor a league like that and you hear the stories of, like, a Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell, those guys,
Ricky Henderson,
legends of the game.
Given his story. You see that?
Reggie Jackson. Yeah. No, that was really good. That was really good. That stuff is really cool, though. To hear all that stuff and to hear the legends that maybe we don't hear about as much. It's kind of cool. Are there other sorts of games that they should play? 800-636-1067 that are kind of like the Rickwood Field game, or any other sorts of things you'd like to see? A football game, baseball, basketball. Heck, I mean, you think about, we've seen one here down at Nationals Park with the Winter Classic and the Capitals, and they were playing the Pens that year, right? Down there at
Nats
Park?
No, they were playing the Blackhawks.
They're playing the Blackhawks. Yeah, I mean, that stuff is awesome.
Carl Alsner was rocking the Oakleys. It was a great look.
Yeah, I love that sort of stuff. I wish they would do even more of that stuff. So, any ideas on that? I think it'd be cool. 800-636-1067. Let's take a break when we come back. It'll be the final hour. We'll talk a little bit more about that, as well as getting into some Nationals talk to wrap up overtime here on The Fan. So, the other night, there was an awesome baseball game on. It was the Cardinals and the Giants. Ordinarily wouldn't care one lick about it, But it was a fantastic, fantastic presentation put on by Major League Baseball at Rickwood Field in Birmingham, Alabama. It was really cool. It was really cool. If you didn't get a chance to watch it, you missed out because they did a fantastic job with it. It's one of the best baseball broadcasts I've watched in quite some time, and I can only imagine how cool it was to be there in person as well. Like, to get to experience that, it was awesome. So, you know, at Rickwood Field, they were there for honoring the Negro Leagues and also honoring Willie Mays. And it was really cool to watch. You know, I thought, you know, the pregame ceremonies and everything were awesome. The national anthem, like everything was really cool leading up to it. And then hearing just the different stories of people talking, some of the legends from the Negro Leagues and all that, and hearing just the stories about Willie Mays, and I think his name is Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro Leagues Hall of Fame, was fantastic. Like, it was really, really cool to just hear all the different stories and see the different stuff that they did, right? Like, you know, Tom Verducci's walking around in the outfield where the original wall was, which is, like, stupidly long. Like, I don't even know how you hit a home run there. You know, hearing all the old tales of who hit the longest home run there. And, you know, I'm sure people have heard the tale about Babe Ruth hitting a ball that landed on a train and didn't stop until it was at its destination. It's the longest home run ever hit. That was at Rickwood Field. And all that stuff, it was so cool to see. And then on the broadcast, they did a fantastic job of, you know, having guys on to tell different stories. And then they even showed an inning like it was 1954. Did you catch that?
No, I didn't.
It was in black and white. They used like old-time graphics where it would pop up, you know, like just the old-time, the name, like nothing else, like just name, batting average, and art, like it just very simple stuff. It was really cool. One of my favorite broadcasts I've ever watched. They did a fantastic job with it. And I think Major League Baseball, as much as we love to hate on them for some of the stuff that they do, they've done a fantastic job with some of these destination games. Like, you think about this game, and I think they did a great job of honoring Willie Mays and honoring the tradition and the history of the Negro Leagues. And they did a really good job with what happened this year, obviously the passing of Willie Mays, but they're integrating the stats from the Negro Leagues into Major League Baseball history, which, you know, has been caught with some mixed reviews, but generally it's been positive. Like, they should be recognized. They are legends of the game, and I think that's really cool. You add all that in and then have that culminate with a game at Rickwood Field. That was really cool. But you think about the Field of Dreams game, you know, the last couple of years has been really cool as well. Those sorts of things are awesome.
Like the games in Williamsport, too?
Yeah, like the game in Williamsport. Like, I think they do a really, really good job with that stuff. You know, as much as we love to give them crap about different things, like, they've done a fantastic job with these destination games of making them intriguing, giving you, you know, a reason to want to watch these things, pulling on the history, pulling on some of the various storylines, and doing a really good job of it. And the settings always look really cool. Like, you think about that Field of Dreams game, who wouldn't want to? If you've watched that movie, who wouldn't want to go there and just play catch? Or as they say, have a catch, right? Like, who wouldn't want to go there and just play baseball? It's really cool. And you think about Rickwood Field and the history there where Willie Mays made his debut and the cool stuff there and all the stuff surrounding that. That was awesome. Like, that looked like, you know, you were put in a time machine and went back in time and watched old school baseball back in the day, which was really cool. So that was fun to watch. You think about even some of the other sports that have done stuff like this. Some of my favorite things were, remember when they'd have basketball games, college basketball games on the aircraft carriers? Like, how cool is that?
Oh, man, we need to bring that back so bad.
Like, that sort of stuff I really like. I think that sort of stuff is really cool. What are some other ideas for stuff like that? That would be cool if leagues could introduce that, or even colleges could introduce that. 800-636-1067, if you want to hop in on the MGM National Harbor listener lines. What are some other ideas for some stuff?
One just came to my head. A football game on the infield of a NASCAR race.
They've done that.
When?
Not during a race.
I think they should.
But they've done it.
I think
Tennessee
they should.
And Virginia Tech played a game at Bristol. It's the largest attended game ever. Remember, like, and they had some stupid large scoreboard that was like, I would not trust playing under that thing, by the way. But it was held up by a bunch of cables right over the field, like that. That was crazy. Let's see how many people attended that, because yeah, that is a good one. Virginia Tech and Tennessee, I believe, was the game. But what are some other ideas for those sorts of things? So they played, it was September 10th, 2016, at the Bristol Motor Speedway, 45-24, Tennessee won. I'm trying to see what the attendance
was. Oh, I've got it.
What was the attendance?
I want you to guess.
Well, it's too late now.
156,000.
Yeah, 156,990. That is really cool, though. That's a great idea. It really is a good idea. That's pretty cool. Now, I can't even imagine sitting on one of the end zone seats. You couldn't see the game.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Like, you couldn't see the game, but that's a pretty cool one. What are some other ones, though? I've got some ideas. So I've got one. Logistically, I have no idea how you can make it happen. No idea. But I think it would be really, really cool. Maybe it's more something you have to do with an exhibition. How cool would it be to watch a bunch of NBA players or high-level college basketball players playing a game at Rucker Park?
Yeah.
In NYC. And even if it's something where you can find a way to, like, near that area and, like, I don't know what you'd have to do, but to put down a hardwood floor and they could go play on it. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
It'd be sick.
I would love something like that. Another one, I have an idea, because it's not necessarily... And you think about those destination games, like those are used, you know, once every couple of years, once every year or whatever. This one's used multiple times a year because it's a Packers home stadium, Lambeau. Play a Super Bowl there.
See, that's the thing that's rubbed me the wrong way about Super Bowls the past, I don't know, 15 years or whatever. Let's get them outdoors. Let's get them out in the elements,
well,
man.
Okay, so I'm...
Real football is outside.
In general, I am one when it comes to the biggest game of the year. I want to take away all the variables. I want it to be the two teams going against each other.
Not real ball.
So I'm all for playing it in a dome, which I don't like domes in general. I kind of like open stadiums. So I actually don't even mind SoFi, but I would prefer natural grass.
Yeah.
I'm a natural grass fan.
Big time.
But... when it comes to playing in a Super Bowl, I like taking away the variable of the weather, and you truly just play the two best teams against each other, and that's it. But they played a Super Bowl in New York, and it rained.
It's true, it did.
So, like, I don't know. I know it's going to be cold in Green Bay in February. Believe me, I've been there. So I understand. But I don't know. I think it'd be cool to have a Super Bowl at Lambeau Field. Like, the history of Lambeau.
Completely agree.
There's zero chance it would ever happen.
Cowards.
0.0% chance it ever happened, unless they somehow built some sort of canopy over it. It's not going to happen.
A big tarp.
But I would love if they could do something like that. Are there any others? It is kind of funny, though. I will say this is a little bit funny. Like, with baseball, they do a Field of Dreams game. That's literally off a movie.
Yeah.
like at least with Rickwood Field, like, you're honoring the Negro Leagues, which it's been far too long. But also, by the way, whenever you honor a league like that and you hear the stories of, like, a Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell, those guys,
Ricky Henderson,
legends of the game,
given his story. You see that?
Reggie Jackson.
I'm sorry.
Reggie Jackson. Yeah. No, that was really good. That was really good. That stuff is really cool, though. To hear all that stuff and to hear the legends that maybe we don't hear about as much. It's kind of cool. Are there other sorts of games that they should play? 800-636-1067 that are kind of like the Rickwood Field game, or any other sorts of things you'd like to see? A football game, baseball, basketball. Heck, I mean, you think about, we've seen one here down at Nationals Park with the Winter Classic and the Capitals, and they were playing the Pens that year, right? Down there at
Nats
Park?
No, they were playing the Blackhawks.
They're playing the Blackhawks. Yeah, I mean, that stuff is awesome.
Carl Alsner was rocking the Oakleys. It was a great look.
Yeah, I love that sort of stuff. I wish they would do even more of that stuff. So, any ideas on that? I think it'd be cool. 800-636-1067. Let's take a break when we come back. It'll be the final hour. We'll talk a little bit more about that, as well as getting into some Nationals talk to wrap up overtime here on The Fan.